Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors, episode 64. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and it's great to have your company. Before we dive into this week's episode, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast, and thank all of my listeners who've taken the time to rate and review the show. Not only are your kind words a great source of encouragement, but they also help new listeners find the podcast. Another way that you can support the work I do is by becoming a Talking Tudors patron. It's super easy to do. Just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll receive lots of fun perks and be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. February's prize is a copy of Uncrowned Queen, The Fateful Life of Margaret Beaufort, Tudor Matriarch by Dr. Nicola Tallis. Thank you to Michael O'Mara Books for sponsoring this wonderful prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about Anne Boleyn's songbook is Dr. Lisa Erkovich. Dr. Erkovich is a professor of musicology and ethnomusicology, chair of the Department of Music and Drama, and former founding division head of Arts and Humanities at the American University of Kuwait. She also holds the post of general editor of the College Music Symposium, Journal of the College Music Society. Before joining the American University of Kuwait, she was a full-time professor at Boston University, where she held a joint position in the College of Fine Arts, the College of Arts and Sciences, and the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences. She has taught at several U.S. institutions, including Bucknell University and the University of Maryland. My conversation with Lisa straight after this short musical break. While Lisa was the director of the Boston University Collegium Musicum for 4 years, her ensemble performed her transcriptions of the Anne Boleyn Music Book, MS 1070, of the Royal College of Music. The song you're about to hear is called Paranymphus. Anne Boleyn's name appears with this piece in the manuscript. I am grateful to Lisa for permitting me to publish it. Prepare to be transported. Welcome to Talking Tutors, Lisa. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, I'm really excited to talk to you today. So let's begin with you just introducing yourself to our listeners and telling us a little bit about your background.
Well, I'm head of the Department of Music and Drama at the American University of Kuwait. But before coming here, I was a professor at Boston University in the United States. And there I was in charge of Renaissance music, and I conducted the early music ensemble and taught all the graduate courses in Renaissance music.
Okay, and when did you actually first become interested in Renaissance music?
Well, I got my master's at Florida State University. And while I was there, they had a really vibrant performing Renaissance music ensemble. So when I was there, I got involved with that ensemble just because there were, you know, when you first enter the program, they offer you all these courses you could take. So I just thought it was interesting. And so I started to take more and more Renaissance courses there. They had a really important professor who specialized in performing early music, Jeffrey Kite Powell. And it was through him that I learned to play the crumb horn and the recorder and then learn more about the transcribing the old notation. And so that really kind of kicked me off. And I wrote my master's thesis on a 17th century composer. And then when I went into my doctoral program, they found out I had played in the early music ensemble at Florida State. And then they asked me to play at the early music ensemble in University of Maryland. And they happened to have a really strong Renaissance program there too. So I just got involved from there and stayed with it.
Okay, now the Royal College of Music in London is home to a book that's often just referred to as Anne Boleyn's music book. Could you tell our listeners about the appearance and the contents of this particular book?
Okay, Anne Boleyn's music book is really unusual. It's big. It's 268 pages. It's thick. It's on paper rather than parchment. It's not of the highest quality. It doesn't have gold illuminations that you would find for a king or queen, but it's not completely without decorative merit. So, and it's strange. It includes 39 motets, which are Latin pieces, normally religious pieces, and three French chansons. The last one actually is like a drinking song. And it's all in this volume, and it has this enigmatic sign. It concludes the name of Mistress Anne Boleyn in the middle of the book. There's 268 pages, and her name appears on page 157 under an alto part. And the book is in, there's a lot to it. First, that it's on paper is unusual. It's not, normally books for kings or queens would be on parchment skin, some kind of pig skin or something. But this is on paper. The book is in gatherings. So we have 13 gatherings in the first part of it and 5 gatherings in the second part. And the first part was an individual unit at one time. And then the 5 gatherings of the second part were added to it later. And then those couple of songs were tacked on at the end. We know this from the watermarks on the paper. And also the dating of the pieces, the way the book was put together.
That's fascinating. So there, I know I was doing a little bit of research and reading some of your work that you've done. And I read that there are 12 anonymous pieces in the book as well, and 8 of which seem to appear in no other source. So what do these unique pieces suggest about the composer or the reason why it was composed in the first place, or commissioned, I should say, in the first place?
Well, if you look at the book, the first 3 gatherings have initials or ornaments at the beginning of them. There'll be little images of a woman's face or animals or flowers, and they're painted in red and blue, simple red and blue. And that's these first 3 gatherings. And on the both sides of the first 3 gatherings, there's just a blank piece of paper. So it's believed that these first 3 gatherings were the original core of the book, and that they were the scribe copied in the music and then sent them over to an atelier who put in the decorations. Now, if you're going to decorate a book like this, that means it was a commissioned for someone. It was a gift, because regular musicians don't go all that trouble to decorate the initials of their book. So this is some kind of a gift. Now, it's not like other books, like chansonnets, are like small French song books that are, you could just slip into the pocket of your dress and you could walk around with these, or small poem books. Those are often kind of gift type of books too. This is bigger. And what we can tell from this one is that people sang from it, because when you open up the 2 pages, you can see all 4 parts, the soprano, alto, tenor, bass. So it could be laid open, people could stand around and all read from the same thing. Now, the beginning of the book, these first 3 gatherings with these decorations, contain these unusual pieces that appear in no other sources, these unica. And when you find an old book like this that has unique pieces, it normally indicates they're written for a specific patron in mind. And here, We have images of women in these little figures, and we have references to wedding. Like, for instance, the famous nuptial vows, what God has put together, let no man put asunder. And songs and texts from the Bible that you would find in wedding books, you know, things about the Virgin Mary and birth and fertility. That whole first section of the book makes it pretty clear that this was commissioned for a wedding, something to do with a woman. There's definitely a strong woman presence, more so than you would find in a book that would be given to a man. So we think that this book, or it's agreed upon, has something to do with a wedding or talking about By dating the pieces around 1505, 1509. And what's interesting is that this book, even though it bears the name of Anne Boleyn, the handwriting, the compositions, the paper, all come from France or Belgium, Franco-Flemish style, which was very, very popular during this time period. So here we need to think a wedding around 1505, 1509 that has to do with France. But yet, later in the book, we have Anne Boleyn's name. So we kind of, so my job was to kind of take all these clues and figure out what the heck is going on here. Where did this, why was this book made and who was it made for?
It's an intriguing puzzle, isn't it? It's just fantastic. So one of the reasons, and you've mentioned this, one of the reasons why it's associated with Anne, of course, is because it has her name written in it. Can you tell us a little bit more about the inscription, what it looks like, where it's placed, that kind of thing?
Well, it's a musical name. It has Mistress M-R-I-S, and the I on the mistress is a fermata, or it was a signum congregantiae in those days it was called, which means it's a musical note, like it's a dot with a half a semicircle above it. You normally find it a bit. So it's a little cute little way to dot her I. And then A dot Boleyn. And then under that is her father's motto, now thus. Her father was this very ambitious ambassador in continental Europe. He was in Brabant and France. And so this was kind of his motto. Okay, now things are like this, but they're going to get better. And then after her name, Mistress A. Boleyn, it has three short notes, three minims and a longa. So it's, you know, people used to joke it was like Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, da, 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 short, 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 long. But there's been other speculations about what that little note means. And it's close to the alto part. So, you know, I surmise Anne saying the alto part. Why else would you put it close to the alto, right underneath the alto part, her name in the middle of this book? It's contemporaneous. That little note, it comes from that time period, somewhere in the early 1500s. Now, she only used the title mistress up until 1529. So this was long before she was queen. So the different speculations that this is Anne Boleyn's book as queen are, you know, inaccurate, because she didn't use that title. You would never call a queen by such a lowly title and put her name in the middle of a book like that. Books that went to queens that were commissioned for them, their names would have been at the beginning of a gathering, the beginning of the whole book, somewhere, you know, big and bold, and not with an old title that your father, you know, it was based on her father's advancement would be her title. So this is a title she only had until 1529. She came back to England. She was on the continent up until 1521. So she's back in England. So she used that title from her birth. She was either born in 1501 or 1507 up until 1529. And most of those years from her birth till 1521, she was, you know, in France, just seven of those years. And then she came back, like I said, but the book is so French, the character and the quality and the paper and everything is French, that only makes sense to think that her name was entered, or that book came, you know, when she was in France, and she got that book in France. And then, you know, you can speculate, now thus, I'm Mistress Anne Boleyn, now thus. The reason she came back to England was to get married to an Earl, James Butler. In 1521, she was called back to the English court. And, you know, then there's, you know, one could speculate, I'm Anne Boleyn now. And it's also, her name appears in a marriage piece. It's called Paranymphis. It's the angel Gabriel, who is the bridegroom, coming to the Virgin Mary, you know, saying, you know, Hail Mary, full of grace, you know, but it's about, it has to do with a wedding and a bride. And here's a piece. And it's also a really unusual piece in that it's an experimental piece by the French composer Compère. He made all four voices in the same range. Now, normally, you know, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, a bass can't sing the soprano, a soprano can't sing the bass. But when you make all voices in the same range, all women could have sang all four parts, or all men without children, without boys, could have sang all four parts. But it's really interesting that many pieces in this songbook are in similar ranges. So they could have been sung by a group of all women, and you could have just put an instrument on the bass. There was a lot of different ways to do this if this were a woman's court book.
Okay. And now you mentioned that obviously other people have, you know, have thought other things about this manuscript in the past, including the musicologist Edward Lewinsky, who wrote about the manuscript in the early 1970s. And he concluded that it was a book made for Anne during her queenship. And you've already given us some reasons why you think that's not the case, and very compelling reasons, I think. He also felt that Mark Smeaton, the court musician who was executed alongside Anne in May 1536, may have been the principal scribe or had something to do with it. Now, obviously, your research has led you to a really different conclusion, and namely that's that the core of the book was made much earlier in France and not made specifically for Anne, but rather gifted to her. Is that right? Is that what you're thinking, that it was a gift during her time in France?
Absolutely. The book, nobody would make a book like that for a girl that was a mistress. I mean, we're talking, she's either 7 or 13. She's not of any royal blood. This book was commissioned for somebody. That was expensive. That took some time. I mean, there's no evidence that such a book would ever be prepared for somebody. She was of lowly status. She was a lady to a queen in Claude. She was a maid. And it took now that's a great position, but she's still a girl, and there were many of them. So there's no indication. And also the music doesn't really date for her. It comes a little bit before her. So, yeah, absolutely. I think it was a gift to her.
All right. And so if it wasn't, you mentioned that you think a woman, it was perhaps made for a woman, for a marriage, for an important woman, obviously royal maybe. Do you have any idea who are you thinking it may have been made for originally?
Well, okay. So Anne goes to Brabant when she's, we're not sure what age she is, but it's in 1513, in the court of Margaret of Austria, which was the grandest court of all of Europe. And here she's raised among these little kids who all grow up to become royals, kings and queens, the future queen of Portugal, Charles V, the future Holy Roman Emperor. So she's in a classroom with other kids who are being raised for greatness. This, I think, later, and you'll see this, you know, why did she become queen? Why did she? Because she was raised with queens. She knew how to behave like a queen. She knew what they were supposed to do. A very unusual raising, childhood, that a lot of courtiers would never experience. She did in continental Europe. So she's 1 year at the court of Margaret of Austria, and then she's called to go to the court of France, which is second in grandeur to the court of Margaret of Austria, because Mary Tudor, Henry VIII's sister, was going to marry the old King Louis XII, and she didn't speak any French. So they needed a kid who spoke, was British, that was English, but also spoke French and could help Mary Tudor with translation. So Anne Boleyn's called over to the court of France, and her father is well-loved in both these courts. Everybody laughs with him, and they like him, and he said, take my daughter, she's great. So she's over there, and she goes into the service of Claude, and Claude is the new, I mean, sorry, Mary Tudor. But Mary Tudor's only married a few months, and then the old king dies. So she's sent back to England. But the French liked Anne Boleyn so much, they said, we want to keep her. So she stays on in France, even though the English queen had gone, Mary Tudor had left. And she goes into the service of the new queen, who's Claude. And Claude marries the new king, Francis I, or she's married to the new king, Francis I. Now, Claude is quiet and mousy, and apparently she suffers from deformity. And so Claude isn't really the power woman of that court. The really powerful women of that court are Claude's mother-in-law, Louise of Savoy, and Claude's sister-in-law, Margaret d'Alençon. And these two women, along with their son Francis the King, they call themselves like the Holy Trinity. They really, they're a tight group, they're colorful, they're smart, they're, you know, and they're kind of running the show. But they like little Claude. And in fact, Claude is Louise of Savoy's Claude's guardian. So wherever Claude goes, Louise goes. And Anne Boleyn's there because Anne Boleyn is the little girl in waiting, maid in waiting to Claude. And also this Margaret d'Alençon is there. So you kind of have Anne Boleyn being connected to these two women, Louise of Savoy and Margaret d'Alençon, who were very powerful and very sharp and very smart. And they loved music. Louise of Savoy played the dulcimer and sang. And Margaret was famous, her court, for having just surrounded by poets and artists. And she was an author herself. They said she wrote faster than a scribe. You know, she wrote many books and penned them and had songs. And she had song composers around her, poets, especially this guy Moreau. So when we look at a book in France, from France, dating around 1505 to 1509, from, and the composers are at the court of Francis. All these composers, all except one, were big French court composers of that time. They were walking around in that court. Who would have had this book? And it's associated with women and a wedding. It leads us, if we're connecting Anne Boleyn and the French court, it leads us right smack to Margaret d'Alençon or her mother, Louise of Savoy. And both of these women were engaged in the time this book would have been made, around 1505 to 1509, both of these women were engaged in possible weddings. It was proposed that in 1505, that Henry VIII, young Henry VIII, would marry Margaret d'Alençon. And then there was a note from the father, Henry VII, and I'll marry the mother. The mother, Louise of Savoy, was 28 years old at that time, and Margaret d'Alençon was 13. So both were within marrying age. So there was like a joke that the Tudors would marry these French women. That was, you know, before the time of Anne Boleyn. That fell through, and in 1509, Margaret d'Alençon married the Duke of Alençon, and so that was another important wedding. So it's possible for any of these betrothals these women were proposed to be engaged in, that book could have been prepared for them. A French book with characters that you know Louise of Savoy loved, that she appear in her other books, the compositions that Margaret d'Alençon liked, that appear in some of her other things, are all inside this MS 1070, this music manuscript, the Anne Boleyn music book.
Okay, and so when Anne returns to court, you know, early 1520s, this book obviously comes with her to England. Is there any evidence to say that anything was added when she was back in England, or is it all kind of from her time in France?
There's no indication. The hands, the pieces, there's no indication anything in England was added to it, you know, other than her name. And she may have penned it. I mean, if you look at the H, the way she drew her H in when she was Lady Anne Rochford is the same. But it's a kind of a common H. But nothing was really added to it. What's interesting is that this book is 39 religious motets, Latin songs. Normally, and one reason nobody even thought that this would be a woman's songbook is because they didn't think women could sing this kind of music. It's really, really difficult. This is for the pros. This is for the guys in the chapel that spend their entire lives from the age of six becoming professional musicians. It's really hard music to perform. And so nobody thought, why would a bunch of women be able to sing or play off of such a thing? It wouldn't be done. You know, women could sing these cute little chansons, these little folk songs and things like this, more simplistic, but not this tough polyphony in Latin, really complex music. But what it attests to, and we know when we talk about the character of Anne Boleyn, of all her skills, you know, she was one fantastic in music and dancing. She played the lute and the harp and the rebec, which is a bowed instrument, the flute, you know, and she sang beautifully. So she's highly musical, but so were all of these women. It's really kind of overlooked that their musicality. So the fact that she brings this book back to England, and obviously it's a performance book. We can tell because the corners are dog-eared or they're dirty, people turning the pages. Also, people added in sharps and flats, you know, to help them sing and make sure they hit the right note. So there's a lot of indication that they did that. Would they have performed this in England? Absolutely. I mean, there's no radio, there's no YouTube, there's no iPhone. And here you've got, it's like being on a desert island and getting a new book to read. You know, like, wow, we have something new and exciting. And, you know, it must have just been fantastic at the English court to grab this and see what's going on in the continent. What are the compositions like? And what, you know, really fascinating type of book.
Absolutely. And now there's been, you know, a lot of debate about how genuine Anne's friendship was with people like Marguerite and Louise. But obviously, this kind of suggests that it was a genuine friendship. Do you want to comment on anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, it's totally overlooked, this relationship with Marguerite. Not only this book, but in general history, if you go back and you look, what Anne writes to her when she's queen, my greatest wish is to see you again, aside from having a son, is to see you, Marguerite, again. And then when Anne was going to escort Henry on a trip to France, she said, you know, they wrote to the French court and said, please bring Marguerite, don't bring his new wife, you know, Eleanor or whatever her name was, please bring Marguerite. And then there's two historians, pretty valid historians, that were just a few decades after Anne died, who both comment on
that Anne was in the service of Claude and then later went to the service of Marguerite. So that she has this close relationship with Marguerite's often overlooked, but definitely there's signs in this book, even the initials and the French pieces in the back that are written by a best friend, the words are by a best friend of Marguerite's, are her initials, M.A. M.A. are above this piece in the back that's in French hand and by her friend. And, you know, it's just too much to be a coincidence that you know, these connections between these people.
Yeah, I agree. I think it does show a genuine friendship there. It's fantastic, isn't it, imagining her having that book opened and performing. And as you say, she was known for being an excellent musician. So it's so wonderful thinking of that image. And that she may have even written her own name. That's really interesting too. You know, I think that needs further sort of study and comparing with her other surviving letters. Not that many of them, but yeah, a few of them anyway. That's really fascinating.
Yeah. That interaction that they had with these musicians is really something. And it's, you know, it's an uphill battle to show this connection between her and the French court. There is pushback today. People still trying to say that the book is English, people still trying to associate with Mark Smeaton, you know, there's no way that's a book from the 1530s in English hand. It has no similarities. But, you know, in 1971, there was that Lewinsky, like you mentioned, Lewinsky had made this assertion that it was a book for Queen Anne. And this has been a big problem. Lewinsky was born in 1908 in Germany, and he came to the United States during World War II. And he was intelligent. He was a brilliant man, and he becomes a professor at University of Chicago. And he would have wonderful ideas, and his research was fantastic. And then he would make like a left turn right at the end and say something crazy. So Lewinsky even argues this book is, you know, that looks like French paper, and those are French songs and everything, but it's made in England. He did this with other manuscripts, like the Chigi Codex. He said, that book looks Italian. It's Italian composers, but it's made in France. And so I talked to the people that came after, and I after him, and they were like, "Wow, you know what Lewinsky did is he." I said, "What was his legacy?" And they said, "His legacy is leaving us 50 years of research to undo." And I said, "How did he get it published? How did his work get published? Wasn't it peer reviewed?" And they said, "No, he was such a big name. He was so famous that he could get around peer review and just put things out there." And then people that don't really know these manuscripts just assume, "Oh, okay, it's an English book. Okay, it's for the Queen." Well, we're seeing the same thing now, you know, with people are publishing without peer review in the day of the internet, and they can get around it. And we're seeing in the last couple of years, the facsimile of this book has a preface in it and even websites related to it where they still are saying, you know, this is Mark Smeaton's hand and these kind of crazy things. And the people that are writing this don't really understand these manuscripts. You know, there are very few of them, and they're really specialized, and you really have to devote like a good, you know, I spent, I don't know, 10 years, 13 years, you know, really just involved in Anne Boleyn. In fact, this is so strange. I first heard about this manuscript from my professor when I was a doctoral student. And he discussed it and how Lewinsky was kind of off course. And then he mumbled, "Oh, somebody ought to do this as a topic." And I thought it was so fascinating. That's when I grabbed it as a topic. And after I'd spent, you know, a good bit of time researching it, I found out, oh, you know, Anne Boleyn died on May 19th, which was my birthday. So then I thought, there's always these weird things I hear from people that spend a lot of time on something that they'll find these kind of weird connections. But yeah, then I thought, okay, this is meant to be. I should work on this book.
Absolutely. Yeah. Gosh. So I know, well, obviously, you know, the wonderful Professor Eric Ives in his fabulous biography that I'm sure lots of our listeners have read, especially those with a particular interest in. And he includes a picture of one of the initials, which looks to be a falcon pecking the pomegranate, which you've obviously seen. And he makes some suggestion that, oh, perhaps, you know, that was in relation to Anne's arms, of course, the falcon and Catherine's pomegranate. So was that just a coincidence, that?
Maybe, because, you know, it's also full of Marguerites, and that was a play on Marguerite's name, you know.
Right, okay.
So yeah, there's a lot. And then the goddess Pallas and Juno, they're all mentioned, and they're connected with Louise of Savoy. And so I think you can make more connections to... Ives is great, and I totally, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
His book predates some of my research, but I think there's much, much stronger ties to France. And like I said, everybody who really looked at this manuscript, including Lewinsky, said, you know, it looks, that's French paper and that's French handwriting and that's French music.
That's fantastic. I'm so glad. That's why I was so excited to speak to you, because there's nothing I like more than doing a bit of myth busting and clarifying things. But, you know, people are very knowledgeable now. As you say, they have lots of resources at their fingertips, but it's always fantastic to hear from someone like yourself who's dedicated extensive amount of time to researching this for us to get, you know, the facts, which is great. So you've obviously handled this manuscript a lot. What did that feel like to handle something like this and know that so many incredible women have obviously handled it and been inspired by it, performed with it? How did that feel?
That's funny. It's at the Royal College of Music. And I remember when I first went to see it, it was just so exciting. I, you know, waited so long and I finally got to get my hands on the manuscript, and it was just absolutely wonderful. And it always looks different, you know, when you see it in person than when you see it in, and in those days, you know, we didn't even have proper photographs of it. You know, I just saw like microfilm of it and what I could print off a microfilm when I first saw it. So it was absolutely fantastic. And then to see how it was well worn and the notes that were written inside of it it's like nothing else. And then it's on paper, because, you know, normally you just don't see manuscripts like that on paper. They're on parchment, big crinkly, you know, pages. And this wasn't like that. It was very unusual. It was absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, I've only seen, and I'll add a link in the show notes to the manuscript has been scanned or photographed and is available online to have a look at the whole thing. But of course, you know, you can't see those little things like the doggy ears and how well worn it is, and those sort of small things are missed, of course, unless you're able to handle that. So yeah, that's really exciting. So Lisa, at the end of episodes, what I like to do is play what I call a little game of 10 to go, which is just some questions to help us get to know you a little bit better. So are you ready to do that?
Sure.
So what are you currently reading?
I don't read for fun. So I only read because I'm always doing research. So I only read works that are associated with my research. So actually I'm reading a book on, it's various newspaper articles on Khaliji music from the Arabian Peninsula and some of the pop pieces that came out. Yeah.
Yeah, because you do such fascinating work. I was reading your bio and I was thinking, my goodness, how amazing all the work you do. It's fantastic.
Another, you know, because I deal with ethnomusicology and historical musicology, and I always kind of viewed it like historical musicology, it's a different culture and time. In ethnomusicology, I'm dealing with a different culture and space. But either way you look at it, their culture is different from my own. And I'm kind of crack the code and figure out what is so beautiful about this that people like this. What is, you know, whether it's Renaissance music or music from the Arabian Peninsula, there's something about, you know, why is it? You know, where does this secret lie inside these musics? Because they're unusual. You know, Renaissance music's very... When you see movies, they always take out, they never use proper Renaissance music. You know, they always use it's a very specialized thing. It really relates to the people of that time and place.
Yeah, that's so true. Now, I know you do a fair bit of traveling, like for work and different things. So do you have any go-to travel tips that you can share with us about anything related to your travels?
Pack light, yeah. Get shrink bags, you know. Get the shrink bags, shrink up your clothes and roll them up and, you know, go. Yeah. I travel a lot. I have, every month I'm in another country, I think. So, and just relax and enjoy it, you know.
What's an item that's on your bucket list? Anything. Is something you'd like to do in life?
It's a crazy question.
Do you have any of those? You're not a list maker that says, I want to, you know, skydive. I want to visit this place. I want to do that thing.
I've already skydived.
Oh, wow.
Maybe Thailand.
Yeah.
But I travel a lot. So, yeah.
Maybe staying at home is probably one that you'd like. What is a favorite childhood memory of yours?
Oh, just being with my grandmother, I think. I love being with my grandmother. So, yeah.
And what do you do? You're obviously, you know, very busy, always researching, traveling. What do you do to relax and unwind?
Go on vacation. We'll try to go on a nice vacation or go to Broadway. My daughter and I love to go to Broadway. So we go to a show once a year. We go to New York and try to catch a show. And it's a nice way to spend a couple of days. It's one of my favorite times of the year.
And are you known for a signature dish? Is there something you cook up for friends and that's your thing?
Soup. I'm a soup fan. I'm known for making good soup. Beef soup, chicken soup, soup.
Excellent. And what's something you love about where you live? I think you're in Kuwait at the moment, aren't you? What's something you love about Kuwait?
Kuwait's famous for its restaurants. They're becoming this restaurant hub of the Arab world. So I think that's the thing. And I love living near the sea. I can walk to the sea from my home, and I really enjoy that.
Who's a person from history that you admire, and why do you? It can be any period. It doesn't have to be Tudor. And why do you admire them?
I think Thomas Jefferson I've always admired, or George Washington. George Washington, who was president, and they said that we'll make you king, and he said, no, that's not the purpose here. And he gave, sort of tried to do the moral thing, and same with Thomas Jefferson, resigned his a high position and just said, because I don't believe in what you're doing. So people that kind of stand up for what they believe in, their morals, and they're not sort of sold out by fame or money, I really admire that.
And I think you've mentioned one thing, the Broadway time, but is there anything else that you're really looking forward to this year?
I'm going to Italy in a few weeks. Weeks and going with a bunch of taking my daughter and her college friends around. We're going to the south of Italy, and we're all looking forward to that, to enjoy some food and nice weather.
Yeah, absolutely. And the very last thing, Lisa, that we do on Talking Tudors, I ask all my guests if they have a Tudor takeaway to leave us with. And that's basically something for our listeners to go and have a look at after the show. Sometimes people have websites or books to recommend or songs to listen to. Do you have a Tudor takeaway for us?
I would welcome them to go to my website and listen to Anne Boleyn's songbook. I mean, when I was the conductor of the Boston University Collegium Musicum, I gave the transcriptions of many of the pieces to my students, and we performed them. And these weren't just normal students. Boston University has an extraordinary school of music. These were like doctors of voice, these people. You'll notice if you listen to those recordings, the women are just extraordinary. The men were musicians, but they weren't necessarily singers, but they were professional singers, but they were, still pretty good singers. And it's the only place in existence that I know of where these songs have been performed. The Unica are there, the ones that are only in Anne Boleyn's songbook, and it's the only place they're performed with voices. There was a more recent recording done, but with instruments, and it doesn't include the pieces that I include on the website. So I really encourage people to go there and listen, and how difficult they are to sing, how beautiful they are. This is Renaissance Latin music. It's like it's a sense of seamless sound. You don't hear these breaks. And so it really sets this mood of otherworldliness, of godlikeness. The whole nature of that Latin music, that church music, was to make you experience something greater than yourself. And it's very, very difficult. And it's I think they're beautiful. And it's live. So, it wasn't in a studio. Nothing's edited. If somebody drops something, you hear it. But it's kind of nice to know real people singing live with no auto tunes or anything. That you can still hear that.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. I was listening just the other day, and it's so beautiful, and it's like time travel, isn't it? When you listen to that, you're suddenly transported, many centuries ago, that's for sure. So I'll add the link to that, and you very kindly allowed me to share one piece on this episode, so I hope everyone's enjoyed that as well. And thank you so much, Lisa, for sharing your expertise. I'm so very grateful that you made time to talk tutors with us.
It was wonderful to talk to you, and thank you so much for inviting me.
As a parting gift, I leave you now with another song from the MS-1070. This one is called Regina Celi Latare, and it's an anonymous Latin motet, again by kind permission of Lisa.
Thank you.
brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for joining us. I absolutely love to hear from listeners, so if you have any comments or suggestions, or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. You'll also find me on Twitter. My handle is On The Tudor Trail, and on Instagram as The Most Happy 78. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.